This is Raising Reconciliation, by hearing, by listening. We search for understanding and solutions concerning issues affecting multiple Indigenous communities. This is a collaboration between Mount Royal University's Aniskum Center and the Calgary Journal. In this episode, Calgary Journal reporter Monique Labossiere sits down to speak with three members of the Indigenous community on their experiences with the transition from high school to post-secondary.
My name is Jacob Lightning. I'm actually from Morley, Alberta, or Minithni, Coldwater, and I lived most of my life on the reservation there. And yeah.
Awesome. I'm Jonas McLaren. I grew up in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta. Calgary was for my first 9 years, and Edmonton for my other nine, and then I came back when I was 18 to Calgary and started, yeah.
Awesome.
I'm Willa Stitch. My name is Stephanie Jobin. I'm Stoney Nakoda, and I grew up in Calgary, the Northeast.
Perfect. Awesome. And so would you say there's like a loss of culture in that transition from high school to university?
Well, for me, like, I always went to school in the city, so I never had much of my own culture. Mm. I never had much Indigenous culture around me. Like, I always attended Indigenous events held by my schools and Indigenous coordinator, right? So I had that. That was my only, like, main source of having culture in my life. For indigenous culture, but going to a reservation, being around it much more, like after high school, in high school it's different because I always grew up with multicultural people. I've always been curious of many cultures. I've been curious about many other things, but when it came to my own, I didn't know a thing, and I felt like I lacked in that sense, right?
Yeah.
So what made me feel better is when I went to a reservation, I got to experience culture. At the same time, I got to experience culture shock when it came to how people approach certain things.
And do you mind going into some of those?
Well, just like education for one, how they approached education in some ways. Some people didn't care for it. They just shrugged it off and was like, well, I'll get it eventually, right? It's like they didn't have an inner need to go and get engaged into getting into this education that they wanted. It was just like, I'm just here.
Yeah.
They didn't have that much of a push or engaging feeling just to go out and do something with what was given, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was just from my perception, but like, you know, it's just a different culture. Like, it's just a different way of life for me, in terms,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. And how have you sort of, working from Mount Royal, seen that transition for other people?
I actually viewed a lot. I see a lot of students who do come in, either those who are struggling, but also I see a lot of intimidation as well. Many of our students are first-generation university students, like myself, and coming into an institution like Mount Royal that is massive in comparison, especially to a lot of the schools on reserve or within the community, or even coming directly from high schools. You know, in Calgary, we could look at our biggest high school, and we could times that by 10 to be able to come to Mount Royal, but also very independent and student-led. So that's where the Aniskum Center, we work on a lot of support services and resources on building community, but also with helping Indigenous students navigate the post-secondary life cycle to let them know of resources and supports, because a lot of us are coming in blind. Many of us are coming with a lot of hopes and dreams, but also a lot of expectations as well, but also kind of the push and struggle from society as well. Many of our students, something I hear every single year is that I don't want to be a statistic. I want to make different changes in my life so that our future generation can have more better opportunities, and they won't be the first to go to university, but it's going to become a common thing. So we really focus on helping students navigate the post-secondary life cycle. And I have to say that for our students who do engage with the Aniskum Center on a regular basis, especially the ones who are finding their culture or their identity for the very first time, they tend to be the strongest of students as well.
Awesome. And what would you say is the biggest thing that students come with you as a worry?
There's a lot. I have to say the Aniskum Center, we are a one-stop shop for a lot of support services and resource. We have everything ranging from academic needs to cultural and spiritual needs, as well as community building. We want to make sure that other students know that there are resources and support out there, but there are other people like them who are experiencing the same thing. So really building up that confidence and letting them know that they can achieve anything that they put their mind to, but it's going to take hard work and dedication.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So I wanted to ask, do you think that it is tougher for First Nations students to make that transition from high school to university?
I would say so, most definitely. You know, I could speak from the perception of coming into university, but also completing a diploma and then on to a degree, and also working in the institution as well. I have to say that we do have a lot of struggles, and especially similar ones to first-generation university students, but also a whole lot more packed on, especially when it comes to socioeconomic need, but also with identity as well. Many of our students who are coming directly from the communities, it's not just transitioning in the first year to post-secondary, it's transitioning to a new city. Sometimes we have students who are coming from very remote areas, so coming into a large urban center like Calgary with people who are here from around the world, it's not only learning to be a university student, but oftentimes learning to live alone because you're having to leave your home community to pursue higher education. It's having to learn the ropes and oftentimes really navigating the system on yourself. Everything from setting up utilities to setting up cable and internet to even navigating the bus system. You know, it could be really intimidating. That's why I make sure that in the Indigenous housing program that I administer, that we do have experiences where students can go out into the community. They could experience things like going to an NHL game for the first time, getting on the C train downtown, making sure to tell them to save their transfer or else they're going to get a ticket, but also about what other grocery stores are around or really where they can go. So it's really about getting them connected, but definitely I would say more challenges, but also race-based as well. That's another thing at the Indiscom Center that we support a lot of students with, is that a lot of our students do feel discrimination. There also has been numerous cases where racism has been happening on campus and also having to do liaising with them. So on a regular basis, I meet with a lot of student services. I meet with a lot of faculty members as well to try to liaise, but also have a better outcome for our students, because many students, when they're feeling disrespected or not included or feel like they're not worthy because either they're Indigenous, maybe they're coming in as mature students, to really liaise but also empower them as well so that they go headfirst into the storm and that they overcome those challenges.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Do you guys have anything to add to that one?
Yeah, I guess what Steve says, I agree with practically all of it. There has been, one thing that I can recall is that I was asked by one of my roommates before he left is if I got everything for free. I guess he tried to frame it as, you know, like he was just genuinely curious. I'm pretty sure he was, but he was kind of implying that I did, and I don't know, not too sure how to feel about that one. On one hand, it does make me feel a little bad if I'm viewed as that I got a free ride and whatnot. Yeah. And I guess it's just a little alienating, because I will admit I've been trying my best to make as much friends as I can, but so far the only friends I've made are just other natives.
Yeah.
And wow. That's about it. Everyone else is just an acquaintance. I haven't got, you know.
Right. Yeah.
I have to agree with both Steve and Jacob when it comes to, you know, coming into a setting based on very stereotypical mindsets. But for me, like, I don't have issues making friends with other people. Mm-hmm. I've always been that person to always be kind to others, treat them as they would treat me, you know, show the utmost respect. You know, if they're curious, I've asked any questions, you know, ask away. I'm more than willing to answer in any way. But like, unlike with Jacob here, I grew up in a city where, you know, he had his culture, he had his background on a reservation, right? Me, I never had that. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to grow on what he has, and he's trying to grow on what I have at the same time, right? So looking at that, you know, there's a little bridge of understanding right there where, you know, it's a place where you can talk and make friends.
Yeah.
But for me, I with my multicultural background, like, I haven't made friends with everybody. Like, most of my friends last year were international students, and they always had questions to ask me about, what's it like to be Indigenous? What's this? What's this? What's this? They were always asking me some questions, and I was always willing to answer. And when, like, it came to some stereotypical things, I'm like, no, this is how it works. This is how you have to look at it. This is just a stereotypical norm. And I'm like, I explain this to everyone with how they are. For me, I see the Indigenous people as two kinds of people. Mm-hmm. They're very prideful, and then some are understanding. I choose to be on the understanding side over prideful, because I want what these two have in terms of culture, but at the same time, I'm trying to learn on it, and they're trying to grow, and someone like Jacob is probably trying to grow off me. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I try to be in the middle with everyone else, because say if you were talking to me as if you didn't know any Indigenous life or culture, and you said the wrong thing to the wrong person, that pride would get in the way, and you'd feel like you're talking to a wall. for me, like me trying to be understanding with Indigenous culture in general in an education background, like that was like my whole thing of coming into uni, is to build better relationships and build better structures to help understand people better.
Right.
Because like, someone asked me like, what happens if I ask something this to someone? I'm like, well, there's two outcomes. It's either they're open and understanding and they will talk it to you, or they'll just put up a wall and be like, you're racist. Mm-hmm. I try to be in the middle so I can understand both sides of the spectrum and at least try to build at least a common understanding. That's my goal when it comes to looking at it through that kind of a perspective.
That's interesting.
I also have to just add on a little bit more. When we talk about more challenges that Indigenous students face in post-secondary, it's not just navigating the post-secondary cycle, but also just racism in society. Racism is very, very alive and well. That's why we know Indigenous people are overrepresented in all of the public sectors and underrepresented in areas like post-secondary. But, you know, it's really hard. And the way I could describe it is that we don't necessarily have the same safety blanket that a lot of people from other cultures have, you know, who are living in Calgary or pursuing post-secondary. This is really like our number one plan. This is our only way. We need to give it our all. There's not like, hey, if things don't work out, I could just go crash in my parents' couch. If things don't work out with my own apartment, I can move home. They're going to have a place for me. Oh, you know, my family said as long as I'm in school, I don't have to worry about helping out, that they'll pay the mortgage or they pay the rent. We're really having to stretch ourselves very, very thin just so that we could have a roof over our head, so we could get a little food into our stomach and let alone afford other basic needs. Mm-hmm. My family is very, very proud of me for going to university and for finishing it. However, the amount of love that they had didn't mean that we had unlimited finances. So oftentimes when I was going to university, I had family asking me to help them out because they see us kind of as a pillar of hope, someone who could help them, but also someone who has a little bit of an income as well. So really challenging there, but even just trying to get yourself set up like off campus to get into housing, the amount of discrimination that Indigenous people face when trying to secure private housing is really challenging. I could even share a story of myself as a, you know, Indigenous professional working in a university with post-secondary education. I moved into my house about a year and a half ago. And at that time, it was almost like too good to be true. I was applying to everything. It was all online. I thought I was kind of getting scammed. And then they're like, okay, we'll meet in person. They had no problem accepting my pay stubs, my emails, everything was well. I went one day after work to go do the walkthrough. I got my keys, gave them the damage deposit, and I moved in like 2 weeks later. And then shortly after moving in, it was a Saturday I moved in. On Sunday, I got a call in the morning. I thought my landlord was going to call and be like, hey, how's it going, Steve? Like, how's the house? How was moving? You know, doing good follow-up. But instead, I answered the phone. I'm like, hello? And she's like, hi, Steve. And I was like, hey. She said, you never told me you were Native. And I said, what? And she's like, yeah, you never told me you were Native. And I was like, I didn't know I had to, let alone I know it's illegal. And then she's like, well, first things first, how many people are living in that house with you? I live in a two-bedroom duplex with my uncle. And I said, well, we just signed the lease. It's my uncle and I. It's a two-bedroom house. What are you expecting? And she's like, okay, did you have a lot of, like, your young Native cousins helping you move in? And I said, what? And she's like, yeah. She's like, well, let me tell you this. She's like, first things first, there better only be two of you living in that house. She's like, second, she's like, the gentleman next door called the owner of the place and said that 16 young Native men from the Morley Reserve had moved in. They did a midnight move. They were probably running away from their old house. What am I doing thinking renting to them? They're going to wreck the place. There's 16 of them in there because it's the only way that they're able to afford to pay rent. Your place is going to be very, very damaged, and they're going to end up owing a lot of money in the next few months. And I said, what? And then she, as if she did me a favor, she said, but you know what? I stood up for you. I went to bat. And she's like, I said, you're not like the rest. I said that you work at the university and that you have a good job and that things will be okay. We usually don't rent to your people, but you make sure that you do a good job. And what do you think you say after that? You're like, okay. And I was like, so what do you want to do about it? And she's like, well, we can't do nothing much. You moved in and we took your money. So just try to do a good job for you and your people. This is my story with education degree professional, let alone the countless other stories that I hear of Indigenous students coming in, relocating to Calgary in the hopes of obtaining their education, but the amount of struggles that they go through every single year, especially in the fall semester. I deal with an average of 5 to 10 students who are family students, but are also living in shelters at that time. They have the opportunity to come to school, have, if sponsorship is in place, they'll have their tuition and their books, but they're moving with very limited resources. resources, often using the funds that they have to get them through the month to relocate to Calgary. When you're not able to get secured in a house or an apartment, you're with children, so all of a sudden you start paying hotel room per night, and think about how fast that money goes, and then many of them end up in the shelter, and they're trying to get secured, but the amount of struggles that they go through, and this is something that I hear on a regular basis.
Wow. That's awful. And have you guys experienced like situations like that at all?
Nothing like on the same vein as it, but I'm honestly not too surprised that something like that has happened, because it's just kind of common in subtle ways, and sometimes they do happen, especially with certain family members. But I agree, Steve's totally right with most of what I agree with everything he said, especially with the part about you can't really turn to a family member asking, you know, for a place to stay if something goes wrong. There's nothing for me to fall back here in the city. I got one younger brother who's barely making it as it is, but on that, there's nothing for me here. Mm. And, yeah. Another thing that I find weird, too, is the enormous expectations that are placed on students that do come from the reservation. Because everyone I speak to asks me if I'm still in university. Even if I stop by for a visit, some of them actually think I dropped out already. Because they just don't have high hopes. I think it's just too common in my community and whatnot.
Wow. And do you think there's anything that could be done to curb that sort of negative look?
Honestly, I'm not exactly sure. But I think me personally would probably be if there was better media representation of Native Americans, because currently it's still pretty horribly outdated, and I don't know.
Do you mean to curb the appeal? Do you mean, like, from the Indigenous community or from the non-Indigenous community?
From both. I mean, like, because, like, what you said, like, that's a terrible story. Like, I can't believe that happened to you. But, like, my reaction was obviously different than their reaction because they've had experience of that, but I didn't even know that was something that happened. So I guess, like, what more could be done from both sides? Or I guess, maybe not the Indigenous side, I guess, because they're not.
I think there has to be healing on both sides, you know? Unfortunately, oppressed people, they have a thing of crabs in the bucket, you know, where one person's trying to get ahead and they get pulled down, and that's just an effect and deep-rooted in colonialism as well. But, you know, it's going to take generations of people debunking those stereotypes, redefining of what it is to be Indigenous. I debunk stereotypes every single day in my life, and I meet a lot of people who kind of give racist compliments, but you see a little bit of change in their discussion afterwards. But that's where my passion comes in as a sociologist. I love deconstructing race. I love challenging it. That's where I really was able to find my voice, but also my healing journey as well. And then from the non-Indigenous side, I think opportunities like this, we're an institution that has pushed indigenization, but it needs to happen on a much broader level. Think about maybe what your education experience was from K to 12. How often did you really get to discuss Indigenous people, culture, or history? I know myself growing up and going through Calgary Board of Education my entire life that we never got to discuss Indigenous peoples of Canada. We did only once, and it was at an elementary level in grade 4. We talked about snowshoes and canoes, and there was First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people, that there was fur trade happening, and there was treaties, and everything was happy-go-lucky. Mm. We spent like months on China, months on Russia, the United States, but when it came to the Indigenous peoples of Canada, it was only at an elementary level, and it was condensed down to 1 week, a Tuesday and a Thursday. And on the second day of classes on Thursday, you know, in grade 4, the teacher was like, you know, I think we've covered every single thing that we need to. Let's take a vote. Who wants to read more, or who wants to go and play dodgeball? What do you think every kid in the room did, including myself? Wow. We raised our hand and we went and played, and we never got to revisit it. Even coming into Mount Royal, I started at Mount Royal when it was still a college and before this indigenization began to take off, and there was not a single Indigenous studies course that I was able to take. That's why I really found my voice in sociology, because for the first time we started talking about the unequal treatment. I got to make sense of what happened to my family, and we got to talk about things like the residential school system. We began to talk about things like the 60s scoop. We started talking about things like assimilation and colonialism, and I began to make sense of myself, but also grow my pride as well. And I really always say that university was an educational experience for me, but more importantly, it was a healing journey. I got to discover myself, my family, also learn more about my community and culture, but also instill that pride of wanting to do more, which is a huge part. And I didn't even get it in Indigenous Indigenous Studies course until the second half of my degree. So I think we need to start at a young age because race is a social construct and racism is a learned behavior. You know, we look at our parents, our grandparents, our aunties and uncles and those closest to us to teach us what's right or wrong, what's black and white, what's hot and cold. But unfortunately, along with a lot of those good teachings, they could also pass down things like hate, tell you to stay away from a certain group on the playground, not to hang out with a certain friend because of their culture, religious, or ethnic background. So we need to start at a young age to deconstruct some of those notions and stereotypes, because I often feel that when people hear us speak, they hear our story, but they also learn about the history that's been swept under the rug in Canada, that it's very humanizing. A lot of students, I do a lot of presentations in classrooms, and a lot of people feel like they were ripped off, that they were cheated, but also the connections that we make and humanize the experience, but uncover a whole side of reality to make sense of where we are today, but also how we got there. We didn't wake up one day and decide that life was going to be a struggle for us, that we were going to be overrepresented. And I always say that, you know, poverty is not a part of our culture, but unfortunately many of our people are struggling in the lower socioeconomic gaps. And when we look at people who live in lower socioeconomic gaps, look at the realities that a lot of them are doing to survive, which usually ends up in a cycle of poverty or even going through the justice system and so on.
Right. Awesome. I noticed you nodding there. Did you have anything to add to that?
Like Steve said, it started at a young age, right? For me, like I've had a lot of people growing up that were not Indigenous, but they were all multicultural, and they were all willing to learn different things.
Yeah.
Like over this past year, I went up to visit my family this year for holidays, and I got to meet a family that I haven't been around forever. Mm-hmm. And then this family, we sat down. It turned from a nice family dinner to like a nice, really heated debate on culture, on like politics. It just went south. But the thing is, with this family, they have three different kinds of generations within them. Mm-hmm. They have the baby boomer generation, Generation Y and Z. No, X and Y. Which one is it again?
X and Y.
X and Y. Generation X and Y. And then you got our generation. Then you got our, yeah, you got us. But we sat down through this, and I'm like, I remember the first time I walked into that house, and I was just like middle school, grade 9, middle school. I walked into this house for the first time, meeting new people. And the first thing I heard was, it was the most rude comment in my life. I don't ever want to repeat it. Mm-hmm. But me being young and not knowing myself as an Indigenous person fully, she said one of the most racial things in my life. But that's because she came from a generation where that was what was the norm. Mm-hmm. That was their normal. Yeah. So I understood it. You know, I never bore a hatred for this woman. I never bore a hatred for the family. Mm-hmm. But I grew a lot of respect due to the fact that each generation down that family line, they were changing slowly. They didn't have that mindset of Natives are perceived this way. They changed to where they perceived it a different way. And now with this family, I know their daughter very well. She's Métis, and she's struggling with her identity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just told her, I'm like, nothing's going to be easy. If you want this identity and people are going to tell you who you are not, let them tell you who you are not. Right. But if it's something that means something to you, you go and pursue it, because that's the only thing that's going to be a part of your life that you're going to keep and hold for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. I could have sat there, and I've had many people tell me, you're too white to be Native. You're too this to be Native. You're too this to be Native. I'm on what some people would call an urban Indian. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a city. I never had all these things. I've had my own challenges when it came to finding my Indigenous identity, because people didn't believe me, or they just saw me as, oh, you're not this because you don't have a certain aspect to it. Wow. So I had to find it for my own way, for my own reasoning, because I'm like, well, if I let these people hold me here, it's like Steve said, crabs in the bucket. They're just going to keep me in that same norm that they want to keep me in, and not let me pursue something I love and like. So I do agree with a lot of things Steve said. We have to start at a young age, structure it, mm-hmm. make something of it, and make it, you know, not something to look back on all the time, but something as a ground base to structure to build something better.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, I've gone through a couple of racist situations with my friends that are international. They came here having a great time, and then they're like, they hear these racist comments about Indigenous people. And they would look at them and be like, that's disgusting. That's ugly. And I'm like, this is what people have to live with every day that's Indigenous. Like, yeah, They call me engine and all this other stuff, right? They say all these wrong terms. These people that come from across the world see this and they're like, this is not the Canada we're told about. I even had a friend, he's from England. We went downtown one time and he was very observant and he saw how people looked at me. He was like, everyone looks like they're giving you a dirty look. And I'm like, do you want to guess why? Do you really want to guess? It's up to you. And he's like, is it because you're native? I'm like, that's the only reason. It's because of the negative perceptions that were placed in society that keep us there. But, you know, me, I'm building relationships on a global scale with all my international friends. Mm-hmm. And they see Indigenous people in a different way. For me, I may not be the one to educate it. But for me, I'd rather be the one to build the relationship so we get to the point to where we can make something better, right? And that's on both sides of the spectrum. Because I'm Canadian, and at the same time, I'm Indigenous. I'm both. So I got to do what I can to make this world a better place for our country and our people, right?
So go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick comment on what Jonas was saying. What he was talking about, especially with the urban native label, that's actually really common for us reservation natives to label city natives. In fact, that's what we call them, city natives. And mostly the older generation really look down upon city natives. They think they either don't understand our customs truly, or if they do, it's not from a genuine place. Right. And honestly, it's a pretty horrible thing that's happening in our own communities that we need to work on, but some people just don't want to change, and it's just too easy to point to. We'll make another outsider of, you know, our own group, surprisingly. And yeah.
Interesting.
I just have to say that when you're constantly told by society and by everybody that you meet what you should be doing, how you should be acting, what's expected of you, it plays a lot on the mind. You begin to think that's going to be your reality, especially when you're not seeing on a day-to-day basis. Some people go into post-secondary or having graduation as a common experience in your family or your lives, waking up, seeing people go to professional roles or waking up for jobs on a day-to-day basis. You begin to think that everything that you're told that you should be, what you should be doing and what's expected of you, you begin to think that's going to be the benchmark, and it plays a huge role on mental health, a huge, huge impact on it.
Yeah.
Still to this day, sometimes I sit around and I'm like, I can't believe I got a degree and that I work at a university, you know? And I grew up with my dad working at a gas station, a lot of family involved with the justice system, child welfare, and a lot struggling with addiction as well. And there's times I just sit back and I'm like, oh my goodness, like I think about the amount of cycles I've broken, but not only me sitting back and reflecting on it, but also seeing the change within my own family and seeing the change in my nephew. You know, I helped raise my nephew and he never seen the things that me and my brothers had to see growing up, where my family was struggling either out on the streets, you know, justice system or anything like that. But my nephew didn't see any of that. He only seen his father and I going to university every single day. We raised him as a single parent since he was just a baby. And he's seen us going to university every single day. We made sure we brought him to graduation all the time. My nephew's got to travel with us to the Caribbean, Mexico. He lives a really good life, and he got to see his father buy a brand new house. And my nephew's pride in being First Nation is deeply rooted in culture, but also the pride as well. But, you know, with him, it's not if I go to school or do I have what it takes to go to school, but by him seeing us graduate in the household, holding professional-level jobs, having post-secondary education, it's more so when I go to university, which is a fantastic change to see, you know, within a few generations. And that's where we need to get as a community, but also as a people. So that's where I have hope, and it's also what keeps my passion going in my day-to-day work, because we could become anything we want, but we definitely have a lot more challenges that we have to overcome to get to where we want to be. And there's a big difference between equity and equality. And unfortunately, many people in Canadian society don't take into account the trauma of the past, the state policies where we couldn't even decide if we wanted to go to, say, a Canadian school. By law, we had to attend residential school. I look at even within this area, Treaty 7 is only 141 years old. So I look at my family who couldn't even speak English. You know, a generation or two ago, people who couldn't read or write in English, but were very strongly connected with our language and our cultural values, to could think of how far we've come in just 140 years, yet let alone everyone thinks that this needs to be equality within society. People question, why do things like the Inniskim Center exist? Why do the Indigenous Housing Program exist? And it drives me crazy when people say, oh, I wish I could be Indigenous so I could get those supports. And every time I say, my goodness, if you walked a mile in our moccasins, I'd be very proud if you made it to where a lot of us are today. And many of these students who are walking through these doors and debunking those stereotypes, and no matter what, they're still thinking about the future. And if we didn't have our humility, which is one of our sacred teachings, we definitely wouldn't be here, along with our resilience.
That's awesome. So do you think from like the high school level to teach students more about the Indigenous population and more, do you think that would help at all?
I think it needs to start at a kindergarten ECS level, because that is when you were learning what's right or wrong. When you're 5 years old, you're getting your social norms. That's when you're developing consensus of what is good, what is bad, but also where you're forming your worldviews as well. Yeah. And it needs to be continuously ongoing, because there's many people, especially people who work within our community. We look at education, nursing, policing, justice system, where we look at now, if I was in school, you know, I started school 10 years ago, where there was no Indigenous content included in my courses, imagine the people who are expected to work with our people and even Indigenous liaisons. If they don't have that history, that understanding, they're coming in from a downward viewpoint. If history has been completely hidden and the trauma, they're still expecting the people to conform to where they are today, but also to assimilate without taking into account what has happened to us in the past. So we need to start at a very, very young age.
And do you think that education starting really young would help that transition that Aboriginal people face from going from high school into post-secondary?
I think definitely, because there's a lot of Indigenous people, because of the struggles and our history being taken from us, where a lot of our people don't even know their culture. A lot of our languages have been dying or have been removed because of the shame and struggles that were associated with it. That if we're starting at a young age, many of our students, I have a very famous saying actually, is that the Inniskim Center for many of our Indigenous students is the first step into post-secondary. Well, for many of our other Indigenous, but also non-Indigenous students, staff, and faculty, the Inniskim Center is the first step into identity, culture, and ways of knowing of Indigenous history. We have a lot of students who walk in, and I love hearing that comment when they say, oh my goodness, there's an entire center full of educated, you know, Indigenous peoples. I've never seen this in my community. Nobody in my family went, got to go to university, and to walk into a university and to know that there's a space for us, but that there's educated, you know, Stony Nakota, Cree, Anishinaabe, Blackfoot individuals who can know, relate, and understand what we're going through. It empowers me to want to do more.
Absolutely. So, do you guys have anything to add to that at all?
Not at the moment.
No, yeah, for sure. So you said you were from Cold Lake, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so
Coldwater,
Coldwater,
Morley, Alberta.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. So would you say, like, what sort of things did your high school do to prepare you to come to post-secondary?
I guess in my final years when I was, before I transitioned, I'm actually a mature student, to be honest, because it took me a few years to actually get here. Mm-hmm. This is my first year here. But one thing I do one thing I do remember is that some of my teachers were trying to teach me how to study properly. Mm-hmm. They'd give me a bunch of assignments, homework assignments, because they thought that I would, well, make it to university. Mm-hmm. They had a little bit of, they had the AEP orientation, all that type of stuff. They're getting everything set up, but I do remember they're trying to make the transition easier for me. And they always stress that, you know, it's going to be a different environment. You got to be ready for it. And some of these teachers even went out of their own way to, they spent their own time trying to teach me this, even though they really shouldn't have. They mm-hmm. had lunch break sessions and whatnot, trying to give me as much information as possible before I went. And I think it made it a little easier for me, but not entirely. It's still culture shocked.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Awesome. And then do you think MRU is doing enough to help the transition?
Well, I'm glad the Inniskim Center is actually here. It's been one place that I've been going to consistently, because it's, I don't know, I got, ever since coming here, I've had some pretty bad social anxiety. I'll start sweating. It'll look like I ran a marathon and whatnot. But every now and then I'll just chill out the Inniskim Center. It's a lot easier to take in and focus on my assignments because it's quiet. And I guess I'm just surrounded with like-minded individuals. And Steve is totally right about being surrounded with more educated Native Americans, because usually the communities I've dealt with that are Native American, there's a lot of bad things going on, you know, drugs, abuse, and drama.
Yeah. What do you have anything to say about that? How MRU is helping?
Or maybe not. Comments right now.
Yes.
No. I think I got to see they being from student into staff member, and I have to say that Mount Royal has come a long way within the last few years, but we definitely have a lot further to go. I think we need growth within the Inniscum Center. Luckily, we were able to get a new space to double our size because we were just getting sardined in our old location. But we need more Indigenous staff and faculty on campus so that students see themselves represented. I'm happy that we were able to commit to the Indigenous Strategic Plan. We're overcoming a lot of the goals, but also the pillars. However, we just need more Indigenous staff and representation on campus because there's so much going on, and there's a lot of very talented, very educated Indigenous people who could offer their services and their supports as well. But I think we definitely need more recruitment on a faculty level, but also staff as well to have them in a variety of areas so students can reach out.
That's awesome. And then so what sort of services does the Inniscum Center offer?
Okay, so we have, so we're actually the largest Indigenous Student Support Center at a post-secondary within Calgary. We have a total of 8 staff and 5 programs. One is the Indigenous Housing Program. The second one is Student Success. That matches students up with resources on and off campus, helps students navigate the post-secondary life cycle. We also, the Student Success Coordinator also administers the Indigenous Peer Mentorship Program. So when we talk about many of our students being first-generation university students, we match the incoming Indigenous students, or those who are struggling socially or academically, with a senior-level Indigenous student within the same program, kind of like a big brother or sister, somebody they could have on campus to help show them the ropes, navigate the resources. The third one we have is the Medicine Trail Program. So that's cultural and spiritual support. We offer smudging, also ceremonies available to students and those who want to learn more and connect. They actually do a lot of work with non-Indigenous students, particularly in social work and nursing and also justice studies. We have the Aboriginal Education Program, which we all went through, as well as a lot of, it's actually the longest stakeholder in the Indigenous community. It's been happening for 27 years. That's an upgrading and a transition program for students who are either coming directly from high school, maybe those who didn't get to finish high school, or maybe those who've taken a break for a long time from school. So getting them connected with resources and just coming in, very hands-on approach. And then the fifth program we have is the Aboriginal Science and Technology Education Program. So in the STEM fields, Indigenous students are underrepresented in post-secondary. So we wanted to show them what opportunities are available within STEM, different career possibilities, and help them navigate the life cycle of post-secondary as well. In addition to that, we're a one-stop center. We have relations with the wellness services. We offer counseling within our center, one-on-one, more private discretion, but more accessible. We have writing and learning strategists come from student learning services, multiple tutors, professors host their office hours. We have diversity and human rights come in, or sorry, campus equity and meaningful inclusion to help students if they feel like they're being treated unfairly. We also have student advocacy from SAMRU come in and offer time. We have, I forget, but there's a whole schedule. We're jam-packed. Every service that students would need to reach out, we have them come and offer office hours in the Inniscum Center.
That's awesome.
And it's only continuously growing.
It's crazy how many there are, because the ones I really do need to go to are the days I'm so busy I can't even reach it. it's so stressful. Like, time management. One of the things I need to work on the most, that's not like on a Wednesday, and my classes go from basically 11:30 to 4. I'm done for.
Yeah.
And I'm I need to attend something like this because I need to learn how to plan my time better. Mm-hmm. It's a struggle sometimes.
Awesome. Yeah. Do you guys have any closing thoughts, something you'd like to add at the end there?
I just have to say that, projects like this and working with students is what gives me hope for the future generations, because for many, many years, students were not picking Indigenous topics, and I'm really happy to see that it's become a common part of our curriculum, but also a mandate of the institution.
Yeah, awesome.
What I find pretty cool about Mount Royal also is, with the international program, I'm thinking personally about doing an exchange somewhere else to go and experience another culture, but at the same time, for whoever wants to experience mine while I'm there, they can do it too. That's what I want to do. And at the same time, with the exchange, they have people come here who are, people from around the world that are curious about Indigenous culture. Like, I had a friend last semester, she would always message me, hey, what's going on with Indigenous events? She literally told me at the end of the year, she had such a good mark for writing about Indigenous events or Indigenous things she attended for her grade. She said, I got the best grades out of everything that I wrote for Indigenous people.
Cool.
And I was like, that's pretty cool. I was happy because we need more people like this who are more eager to learn about culture out, like the culture in general, instead of the stereotypical norms.
Exactly.
So like having more minds like that and at least bringing awareness to it will help make not just MRU, but maybe like the world a better place.
Yeah. Awesome. I remember you saying, like, what would be a good way to ease the relationships between indigenous communities and city communities and whatnot? And honestly, I think this is one of them because it's actually pretty cool. We're getting more information out there. We're actually talking to each other, you know?
Yeah.
And usually that doesn't happen because everyone's either, well, like me, shy or just, or just there's some prejudices there and whatnot. It's kind of hard to have a conversation with another group if, you know, if everyone's not on the same foot or on the same page.
You've been listening to Raising Reconciliation, a collaboration between Mount Royal University's Iniskum Center and the Calgary Journal. Thanks to Jacob Lightning, Jonas McLaurin, and Steve Kootney-Jobin for participating. This episode was produced by Monique Labassier, Bill Atwood, and Jackson Reed. The music was created by Ricardo Andres Garcia. The podcast artwork was created by Dion Simon.